crown was not his, or anyone else's, to give away. It lay in the gift of the Witan. In any case, William gave Harold Godwinson men and ships and sent him back to England. A little more than a year later, during the Christmas festivities of 1065, Edward the Confessor fell ill. He died on January 5, 1066, and was buried the next day in Westminster Abbey, which had just been finished. On the very same day, just as soon as the coffin was out of sight, the Witan met and chose Harold Godwinson to be the next King of England. He was not the only choice. Edward the Confessor had, some years before, retrieved Edmund Ironside's grandson from Hungary. The toddler son of the king, who had been saved from death by the King of Sweden and fostered by strangers in Hungary, had married a Hungarian wife and fathered a son named Edgar. Edward the Confessor had brought Edgar back to England and was raising him as an adoptive son. But Edgar was only 14 years old and essentially a foreigner. The Witan preferred a grown-up, one who had already proved himself in battle. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle suggests that Edward himself, on his deathbed, had recommended that Harold follow him to the throne. So Harold Godwinson was declared Harold II of England in Westminster Abbey, the first monarch to be crowned there. At once, William the Bastard began to prepare an invasion. Winds and tides held him off for the time being, but Harold knew that the Norman Duke was on his way. Sure that the Normans would attack in the spring, when the weather allowed, he assembled a standing army and kept them encamped on high alert. A dreadful sign in the heavens, during the last week of April, confirmed that a great threat was approaching. It was, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle says, a sign such as men never saw before, a haired star. The elliptical orbit of Halley's Comet had brought it into sight of England, where it burned in the skies for a full week. But by the end of August, Harold had begun to relax his guard. The English army and navy had been waiting for months, all the summer and the autumn, and a land army was kept everywhere by the sea. When it was the Nativity of St. Mary, the men's provisions were gone, and no one could hold them there any longer. Then the men were allowed to go home, and the king rode inland, and the ships were sent to London. The feast of the Nativity of St. Mary was on September 8th, and it was perfectly reasonable for Harold to conclude that no one was coming. Sailors stayed off the sea during the fall and winter, fearing the same high winds that had driven Harold onto the shores of Normandy 2 years earlier. But just as Harold was returning to London, ready to take up the task of governing his country, two things happened. His brother Tostig, whose anger had tipped over into obsession, had finally convinced Harald Hardrada of Norway that England would reject Harold Godwinson and rally to his banner as soon as he landed on England's shores. The two men had recruited men and ships from the unhappy Scots. They were keeping a close eye on the troop movements in the south, and when the English camps began to break up for the winter, the joint Norwegian and Scottish expedition began to move towards invasion. At the same time, and apparently by sheer chance, William the Bastard lost patience. He was tired of waiting for good winds. Late in the second week of September, he launched his attack fleet into the English Channel, where they were promptly battered by an enormous storm that sank some of his ships, blew others off course, and drowned part of his invasion force. Harold of England knew nothing of the struggle offshore. He was in London when he heard horrible news from the north. Harold Hardrada and Tostig had landed near York, with Harold's Black Raven banner flying above them. A hastily assembled English army had marched out to meet them and had been slaughtered. York had agreed to a formal surrender, complete with hostages, to be carried out on September 25th. In a superhuman effort, Harold rounded up the dispersing soldiers and left London. They reached York on the morning of the planned surrender. Harold and Tostig rode to the agreed-upon meeting place, Stamford Bridge, to find the King of England and his army waiting in place of the cowed citizens of York and their chosen hostages. Both armies drew their swords at once. Henry of Huntingdon gives us a vivid picture of the battle. "It was desperately fought," he says, "the armies being engaged from daybreak to noonday, when, after fierce attacks on both sides, the Norwegians were forced to give way. Being driven across the river, the living trampling on the corpses of the slain, they resolutely made a fresh stand. Here a single Norwegian, whose name ought to have been preserved, took post on a bridge, and hewing down more than 40 of the English with a battle-axe, his country's weapon, stayed the advance of the whole English army till the ninth hour. At last, someone came under the bridge in a boat and thrust a spear into him through the chinks of the flooring. The English army advanced across the bridge and slaughtered the remnants of the Norwegian force. Both Harald Hardrada and Tostig were killed in the fighting. Harald II received the Norwegian surrender from Harald's son and allowed the young man to go home. He took with him the remnants of the Norwegian force, 24 ships out of an invasion force of more than 300. Harald's hard-won victory had just lost him his kingdom. He went into York with his men to provision and rest them for the journey home. They were still in York when another messenger arrived with even worse tidings. A few days earlier, William the Bastard had landed at Pevensey on the southern coast, and there were at least 8,000 men with him, even after the battering from the Channel storms. Harald hurried his damaged, weary, footsore army on yet another forced march. They arrived in the south of England on October 5th, and Harald at once sent ambassadors to William to attempt to resolve the situation without further fighting. William was unyielding. He insisted that Edward the Confessor had intended him to receive the crown of England, and he further accused Harald of swearing a sacred oath after that shipwreck in Normandy to hand over the throne to William. A week of fruitless negotiations made it very clear that William would not leave without a fight. On October 14th, the English army, mostly foot soldiers, met the Norman force of cavalry, infantry, and archers near the town of Hastings. They were killed in droves. Later stories embroider the Battle of Hastings with multiple details, but the oldest account in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle is brief and stark. King Harald gathered a great army and came against him at the Grey Apple Tree, it reads, and there was a great slaughter on either side. There were killed King Harald and Earl Leofwine his brother and Earl Gyrth his brother and many good men. And the French had possession of the place of slaughter. By day's end, every Godwin man was dead, and William the Bastard had become William the Conqueror. There was one heir left in the English line, 14-year-old Edgar, still in London. In a last act of defiance, the Witan met and crowned him as king. Edgar was young, but not stupid. He escaped from his honour guard, got to William, and surrendered as quickly as possible. William sent the boy back to Normandy and ordered him to be treated well. And then William came to Westminster, says the Chronicle, and the Archbishop consecrated him as king. He was now William I, properly crowned in Westminster Abbey. The English struggle against the Vikings had ended. By way of France, a Viking king finally had full possession of the English throne. Chapter 79. The Kings of Spain. Between 1016 and 1108, the Caliphate of Córdoba disintegrates, the northern Christian kingdoms battle with each other, the Muslim Almoravids cross over into Spain, and El Cid accidentally creates an oasis of tolerance. In 1016, the Caliphate of Córdoba, which had risen to a sudden and dizzy height of magnificence, paused at the edge of the crest and then plummeted downwards. The Caliph Suleiman II was captured and put to death by his rivals for power, and the Caliphate itself began to split apart. The catastrophe of 1016 can be traced back 40 years to the same man who led the Caliphate into magnificence, Muhammad ibn Abi Amir, known more widely as Al-Mansur, the Victorious. In 976, the young Caliph Hisham II had inherited the rule of Córdoba on the death of his father. Hisham II was only 10 years old, which opened the Caliphate up to control by his ministers. And of these, Al-Mansur was the most ambitious. He had arrived in Córdoba some years earlier, travelling from his home on the southern coast, and had devoted himself to the study of law, and the task of rising up through the ranks of civil service. Despite his humble antecedents, wrote the 11th-century chronicler Abd Allah, he achieved great things, thanks to his shrewdness, his duplicity, and his good fortune. Al-Mansur, who was around 40 when Hisham II became caliph, saw the child's rule as his chance to grasp power. In 978, through a combination of persuasion and threat, he had himself appointed vizier to the little boy, prime minister and household administrator rolled into one. At once, he ordered construction of a new palace. When it was finished, in 981, he moved himself and the entire bureaucracy of Córdoba into it. Hisham II, now 15, was left in the caliph's palace alone, without daily contact from any of his ministers or courtiers. Al-Mansur announced that the boy had decided to devote himself to good works and kept him isolated. At the same time, the vizier accused of heresy and disloyalty other high officials who might also aspire to power and had them exiled or put to death. His pretext, Abdallah says, was that their survival would have led to much discord and dissension and culminated in the ruin of the Muslims. His name was now spoken along with the caliph's in Friday prayers, proof that he had risen to the top of the palace hierarchy. Al-Mansur may have been ruthless, but he was also an excellent strategist and administrator. He reinforced the Cordoban army with crowds of Berber soldiers brought over from North Africa, and during his rule as vizier, the Caliphate of Cordoba triumphed in battle after battle against the Christian kingdoms to the north. Barcelona, which had been governed by independent Christian dukes for over a century, was sacked in 985. The king of Pamplona, Sancho II, suffered a series of humiliating defeats and finally came to Cordoba to make peace, which Al-Mansur accepted, along with Sancho's daughter as his wife. In 999, the caliph's armies flooded over the border of the Kingdom of León and destroyed much of the city of Santiago de Compostela, which was doubly embarrassing because it was not only Christian territory, but also a site of pilgrimage for Christians from all over the world. The bones of the Apostle James, the brother of Jesus, were said to rest in its cathedral. In all, Al-Mansur was said to have won 57 battles over the northern resistance. He gained decisive victories over the enemy, Abdallah concluded, and during this time, Islam enjoyed a glory which Al-Andalus had never witnessed before, while the Christians suffered their greatest humiliation. Under his capable and unforgiving rule, Al-Andalus prospered, even with the rightful caliph under house arrest. But the rapid expansion had driven the Muslim kingdom on the peninsula past the place where its underpinnings could support it. Beneath the surface triumphs, the foundations were beginning to disintegrate. When Al-Mansur died in 1002, his son Abd al-Malik was forced to fight continuously to keep the borders of the caliphate out to where Al-Mansur had pushed them. He claimed the post of vizier as though it had become hereditary. And he too kept Hisham away from any involvement in government, but he spent the 6 years of his caliphate at war and did little governing himself. During the dank cool October of 1008, he was campaigning in the north against the Christian region of Castile when he caught a chest cold. He had always had weak lungs, and the cold turned into a cough that killed him. Now the decay that Al-Mansur's glorious victories had whitewashed began to show through. Al-Malik's brother, Al-Mansur's younger son, Abd al-Rahman, saw no reason to keep on hiding his power beneath the umbrella of a legitimate caliph. To be ruler in all but name didn't suit him. He wanted the name as well. He forced Hisham II, now in his 40s, to name him heir to the caliphate. This would have brought a final end to the Umayyad hold on the caliphate in Cordoba, and the other members of the Umayyad family, who already resented the privileges claimed by Al-Mansur and his family, and who particularly disliked the high position held by so many Berbers in the army to the exclusion of Arab officers, revolted. Unfortunately, they didn't unify behind a single Umayyad candidate. Some supported Hisham II, others wanted another Umayyad caliph to replace him, and a civil war broke out. Abd al-Rahman and his Berbers fought against the various Umayyad factions who wanted the caliphate back, and the Umayyads fought against each other. In the years of struggle that followed, both Abd al-Rahman and Hisham II were killed. Eventually, the Umayyad claimant Suleiman managed to beat back the opposition and became caliph, but he held the throne for only a handful of years. The civil war had so fractured the kingdom that it was vulnerable to outside attack, but the attack didn't come from the Christian kingdoms in the north. Instead, it came from a Berber soldier named Al-Nasir, who in 1016 marched into Cordoba at the head of his own North African forces, took Suleiman II captive, and beheaded him in public with his own hands. He then proclaimed himself caliph in Cordoba. Suleiman's head and the heads of the Berber chiefs who had fought against Al-Nasir instead of joining him were then cleaned up, perfumed, and preserved, and carried around Al-Andalus by Al-Nasir's men, so that all could see the fate of those who opposed him. Despite the show and tell, Al-Nasir survived only 2 years before he was assassinated in his bath. The rot had set in to stay. After 1018, no caliph managed to rule in Cordoba for more than a few years, and few of the claimants died a natural death. In 1031, the last man to try to claim the title died, and Al-Andalus fell apart into a fragmentation of little city-states. The kings were called Reyes de Taifas, the party kings, each the head of his own tiny political movement. Some were Arab, others were Berber. Over the next half-century, over 30 of these Taifa kingdoms would blanket the former territory of the caliphate. The northern Christian kingdoms had spent their entire existence defending themselves against the threat of the caliphate. Now, as the caliphate disintegrated, the Christians of Al-Andalus were able to draw their eyes away from the Muslim south. They began instead to look at each other, no longer allies, but competitors. The first aggressor in the north was the king of Pamplona, Sancho III, the Great, grandson of the king who had given his daughter in marriage to the vizier Al-Mansur. His ambitions had begun to grow back in 1016. His territory already enfolded not only the fortress city of Pamplona, built by the tribe of the Vascones centuries earlier, and sacked by Charlemagne during his retreat from Al-Andalus, but also the northern region known as Navarre, and the rich upper valley of the Ebro River. As the caliphate to the south turned inwards and started to fracture, Sancho the Great cast a covetous eye on the neighbouring Christian territory to his west, Castile, ruled by noblemen who called themselves counts rather than kings. Sancho the Great began his takeover peacefully by marrying the count's daughter. The next year, when the Count of Castile died, Sancho the Great offered to protect Castile on behalf of its new count, his young brother-in-law, Garcia II, a child of three. Becoming Castile's regent gave Sancho the Great the opportunity to fold Castile into his territory, making Pamplona the largest northern kingdom. Alfonso V, the noble, King of León, took notice. He made secret arrangements of his own to pull Castile back into his own orbit. When Garcia II reached the age of 13, Alfonso offered to betroth the young count to his own sister. Sancho the Great, preserving appearances, agreed enthusiastically to the match, and announced that in order to do his brother-in-law honour, he and his entire army would accompany the boy to León for the formal celebration of the betrothal. No sooner had they arrived in León than three assassins, brothers from the Castilian family of Vela, attacked the boy and stabbed him to death in front of his sister, his brother-in-law, and their retinue. They then fled into the kingdom of Pamplona. This was enough to confirm that they were in the pay of Sancho the Great, but he was no fool. He had hired Castilians to preserve deniability, and when they took refuge in his own territory, he sent armed men after them, arrested them, and burned them to death for murdering the count. If his young wife had suspicions about her husband's role in her brother's death, she never expressed them in public. She became Countess of Castile, which meant that the kingdom had effectively been united with Pamplona. The joint realm, increasingly known as the Kingdom of Navarre, now went to war with León. For the next 6 years, Leonese soldiers resisted the invasion of Sancho the Great's armies. But the war ended in 1034, when Sancho drove the King of León out of his capital city and entered it in triumph. The exiled ruler retreated into the small territory of Galicia, where he was killed 3 years later. Sancho the Great now controlled all three Christian kingdoms of the north, plus a few of the smaller regions. The conquered lands submitted to his rule, the official court history tells us, because of his conspicuous integrity and virtue. In fact, Sancho had gained his kingdoms through ruthless war and manipulation, and ruled them without apology. The history concludes, because of the extent of the lands he possessed and ruled, he had himself called emperor. But the imperial title was merely that. Sancho still thought like a local ruler. Instead of passing the entire realm on to his heir, he decreed that the lands would be divided among his four sons. He died in 1035 at the age of 65, barely a year after adding imperator to his titles. The Christian Empire fell apart. His four legitimate heirs, along with a fifth illegitimate son, spent the next 20 years ravaging each other's territory and fighting for dominance. Not until 1056 did peace descend over the north, and then only because all of the heirs but one were dead. The second-born son, Ferdinand, was the last man standing. He claimed his father's lands for himself, along with the imperial title, Emperor Ferdinand I. Once again, the northern kingdoms were one. The fragmentation in the south had allowed for the unification of the north. The Christian kingdoms of the peninsula, of Spain, had begun to take on a single identity, as the Muslim kingdoms of Spain had fallen apart. But it was not a peaceful identity. 2 decades of inter-family war had prevented Christian Spain from taking full advantage of the collapse to the south, and Ferdinand himself had built his empire on blood. He tried to wash away the stain with devotion. King Fernando always used to see to it with special care, says the 12th-century historian Silense, that the better part of the spoils of his victory should be distributed among the churches and Christ's poor, to the praise of that highest creator who gave him victory. But Fernando was still enmeshed in corruptible flesh, and knew that he was not close to divine grace. When, in 1065, he felt himself fatally weakening and realized that his last illness was upon him, he took off his royal robes and crown and put on a hair shirt instead. He spent his last days in penance and died wearing the garments of a sinner. He passed on both his empire and the tradition of civil war to his three sons. The oldest, Sancho II, the Strong, became king of Castile. His middle son Alfonso inherited León, and his youngest, the little territory of Galicia. But Sancho the Strong was unwilling to leave his brothers in peace. Accompanied by his right-hand man, the general, Rodrigo Díaz, he began a war of reunification. Rodrigo Díaz, better known by his nickname El Cid, Arabic for the Lord, was only in his early 20s at the time, but he had been a soldier since his early teens and was already experienced in battle. King Sancho valued Rodrigo Díaz so highly, writes El Cid's biographer, that he made him commander of his whole military following. So Rodrigo throve and became a most mighty man of war. After 7 years of fighting, Sancho the Strong managed to drive his brother Alfonso out of León. He reunited Castile and León into one kingdom, while Alfonso took refuge in the Taifa kingdom centered around Toledo. But like his grandfather, Alfonso was crafty and willing to shed family blood. He paid off one of Sancho the Strong's own soldiers to kill the king during the siege of an outlying city. By treachery, says the historian Silense, the king was transfixed with a spear by him unexpectedly from behind, and shed his life together with his blood. Alfonso denied until his death that he was involved in Sancho's murder, but the benefit came to him. With his brother dead, Alfonso returned from his exile in the Muslim lands and reclaimed both kingdoms as Alfonso VI of Castile and León. He also inherited Sancho the Strong's army, along with its general, El Cid. Alfonso did his best to buy El Cid's loyalty, giving him a position at court and a royal cousin as his wife. But he never fully trusted his dead brother's general, and over the next few years El Cid was sent on numerous foreign trips, acting as Alfonso's ambassador to the Taifa kingdoms in the south and east. This kept him out of Castile and León and away from Alfonso, but it also gave him a chance to demonstrate his brilliance as a warrior. Sometime around 1080, he was dispatched for a friendly visit to the Taifa kingdom at Seville, which was under the rule of the Arab king Al-Mutamid. While he was there, Seville was attacked by the neighboring Taifa kingdom at Granada. El Cid and his men marched out with Al-Mutamid to assist him in his fight against the army of Granada. El Cid fought so ferociously that he won all credit for the victory. He wrapped up this performance by attacking Toledo, taking 7,000 captives and wagons of treasure back to Castile and León with him. In return for this success and victory granted to him by God, his biographer laments, many men, both acquaintances and strangers, became jealous and accused him before the king of many false and untrue things. Alfonso was jealous of El Cid's reputation and popularity, and he took the attack on Toledo as an excuse to exile El Cid from his kingdom. The anonymous 12th-century poem that praises El Cid's heroic exploits adds that Alfonso also sent his men to sack El Cid's home. Rifled coffers, burst gates, all open to the wind, nor mantle left, nor robe of fur, stripped bare his castle hall. Deprived of his home, his lands, and his profession, El Cid exercised his professional skill in the only way he could. He became a mercenary. His reputation ensured him of employment, and he was snapped up at once by the Arab king of Zaragoza, a Taifa state with its capital not far from Alfonso's border. This put him on the wrong side of his previous employer. Although the two men did not come face to face in battle, El Cid was fighting for the Arabs, and Alfonso VI was planning a serious attempt to reconquer large parts of Muslim Spain. In 1079, he captured the city of Coria, well south of his own kingdom, and by 1085 he had pushed eastward all the way to Toledo, center of one of the stronger Taifa states. When he conquered it, ripples of fear went through the surviving Taifa kingdoms. If Alfonso VI managed to fight his way through the Taifa kingdoms all the way to the coast, he could divide the northern and southern Taifa kingdoms from each other and pick them off, one at a time. They could not fight the determined Christian advance without reinforcements. Led by the King of Seville, the Taifa rulers sent an appeal across the Strait of Gibraltar to the North African Muslims known as the Almoravids. Until this point, the Almoravids had been confined to North Africa. Originally an unruly collection of North African tribes, they had been shaped into a nation by a North African chief named Yahya ibn Ibrahim, who had come to power some 50 years earlier. The tribes had been vaguely Muslim for 2 centuries, but since they were spread across the western desert with no central city or mosque for them to gather around, their practice of Islam had become more and more idiosyncratic. In 1035, Ibn Ibrahim, at that time merely the chief of one of the tribes, had made his way to Mecca for the sacred pilgrimage, the Hajj. There he discovered just how odd the Western African version of Islam was. A reformer by nature, Ibn Ibrahim spent years studying the faith practiced by the Arabs in Islam's homeland, and when he returned to West Africa, he brought with him a missionary, an imam named Ibn Yasin. Ibn Yasin spent the next 20 years among the tribes, teaching them his brand of Islam. It was a militant and ascetic interpretation that ordered the heterodox believers to straighten up, shun alcohol, devote their time to prayer and fasting, study the Quran, and then to spread these practices by force if necessary. "God has reformed you and led you to his straight path," he told them. "Warn your people, make them fearful of God's punishments. If they repent, return to the truth and abandon their ways, let them be. But if they refuse, continue in their error and persist in their wrong-headedness, then we shall ask for God's help against them and wage holy war on them." By 1085, the Almoravids' dedication to holy war had roused them to conquer most of the northwestern African coast. Led by Ibn Ibrahim's brother, Abu Bakr, they built a capital city and central mosque at Marrakesh. They proclaimed their loyalty to the Abbasid Caliphate in Baghdad and took for their own the existing Abbasid laws and customs. In bringing this message to northwest Africa, Ibn Yasin had also brought with him a template for life as an empire, giving these nomads a fast track to nationhood. When the panicked message arrived from Seville, Abu Bakr sent his cousin, the general Yusuf ibn Tashfin, to answer it. Ibn Tashfin transported an Almoravid army across the strait and marched north to fight against Alfonso VI. On October 23, 1087, the combined armies of the Taifa kingdoms and Almoravids defeated the soldiers of Leon and Castile in pitched battle at Sahrayas, southwest of Toledo. The slaughter covered the ground with the dead. "There was no place for a foot but a corpse or blood," wrote one chronicler. Alfonso survived but was forced to flee the battlefield in agony, badly wounded in the leg. The defeat frightened him so badly that he recalled El Cid from exile to fight the Almoravid threat. El Cid agreed to come home in exchange for 2 castles, a small territory of his own, and a written pardon from Alfonso, which stipulated that all lands and castles which El Cid might acquire by conquering Taifa territory would belong solely to him. El Cid helped Alfonso's armies hold the border of Leon Castile in place. Meanwhile, Ibn Tashfin was soon frightening the Muslims of the south as much as he had terrified the Christians. The Taifa rulers who had invited him in knew their history. They remembered the conquests of Tariq in 711, which had first brought Islam to Spain, and they were aware that asking a North African army for help was not unlike asking a fox to guard the henhouse. But they had been desperate. As a shaky defense against Tashfin's ambitions, they had managed to get him to promise that he would return to Africa as soon as the Christians were defeated. By 1091, the promise was ancient history. Abu Bakr had died in 1087, leaving Ibn Tashfin as ruler of the Almoravid lands. Tashfin had conquered Granada, Cordoba, and Seville. Southern Spain had become merely a province of the Almoravid Empire, which now stretched from Marrakesh across the water. But the extent of the empire made it difficult for Almoravid armies to advance much farther north. Alfonso's kingdom remained intact in the north. The peninsula was divided between the 2 empires. The Taifa kingdoms, falling one at a time, were a thing of the past. But with the peninsula divided into Christian and Muslim segments, El Cid resisted belonging to either. Instead, in 1094, he laid siege to the city of Valencia on the eastern coast, between the borders of the northern Christians and the southern Muslims. Once the city was in his hands, he claimed it as his own under the terms of Alfonso's pardon and moved into it. Around Valencia, he conquered himself a kingdom. El Cid was now in his 50s, and he had spent his entire life fighting for Muslim kings against other Muslims, for Muslim kings against Christians, for Christian kings against Muslims, for Christian kings against their own brothers. He was tired of war and fed up with changing sides, and for a brief time, his kingdom was home to both Christians and Muslims, a brief mingling of faiths in a polarized land. El Cid was no peacemaker. He killed the inhabitants of Valencia who opposed him, sacked villages that refused to surrender, and stole treasure from the conquered for his own personal use. But neither was he a zealot. He served neither Christianity nor Islam, but simply himself. Any Spaniard who behaved himself and obeyed El Cid could live in the kingdom of Valencia. In a world divided by religion, the great general's self-interest had accidentally built an oasis of tolerance. By 1097, the Almoravid commander Yusuf ibn Tashfin had conquered almost all of the land that had once belonged to the Caliphate of Cordoba. His Muslim empire stretched from northwestern Africa up into the south of Spain. The Christian realm of León Castile, ruled by the long-lived Alfonso VI, dominated most of the north. The little kingdom of Aragon-Navarre was the junior power of the Iberian Peninsula. The only realm smaller than Aragon-Navarre was Valencia, the independent realm of El Cid, which lay on the eastern coast. Valencia existed entirely through the strength and resolution of El Cid. When he died, Valencia fell. He drew his last breath peacefully in his bed in 1099 at age 60. As soon as the news of his death reached the Almoravids, they marched against Valencia, invaded its territory, and besieged the city for 7 months. His wife finally sent an appeal to Alfonso of Castile, begging for deliverance. She knew that this would be the end of her independence as Queen of Valencia, and so it was. Alfonso arrived with his army and fought his way into the city to rescue her, but he refused to commit himself to lifting the siege. It was far removed from his kingdom, the historian Roderici tells us, so he returned to Castile, taking with him Rodrigo's wife with the body of her husband. When they had all left Valencia, the king ordered the whole city to be burnt. The Almoravids, who had backed away, returned and claimed the burned city. They resettled it and all its territories, the Historia concludes, and they have never lost it since that day. The fall of Valencia was the beginning of a series of changes in the Spanish landscape. In 1104, Alfonso VI's first cousin, once removed, inherited the throne of Aragon-Navarre and began a double quest— to reconquer the Muslim south and to reverse the relationship between León Castile and his own kingdom, so that the larger realm paid homage to the smaller. Like his elder cousin, he was named Alfonso. While Alfonso VI of Castile eventually earned himself the nickname Alfonso the Brave, the 30-year reign of Alfonso of Aragon-Navarre earned the younger cousin the nickname Alfonso the Battler. The Battler's rise to power was assisted by the deaths in rapid succession of Tashfin, Alfonso the Brave's only son, and Alfonso himself. Tashfin died in 1106 at nearly 100 years old. Preoccupied with age and infirmity, he had allowed the armies of León Castile to push deep into Muslim territory in the years before his death. He left the Almoravid Empire to his son Ali ibn Yusuf, who recognized the need to drive back the Christian invaders. In 1108, an Almoravid army commanded by Ibn Yusuf's two younger brothers laid siege to the border city of Uclés. Alfonso the Brave of Castile sent his 15-year-old son Sancho at the head of 10,000 troops to lift the siege. He had given the boy two experienced generals to help him, and he expected a quick victory. But with the elderly Tashfin dead, the Almoravids had regrouped. In vicious fighting around the city, young Sancho and both of his generals were killed. The Almoravids occupied Uclés, creating a new frontier. Alfonso the Brave, devastated by his son's death and in failing health, had one surviving legitimate child, his daughter, Urraca, who had been married and widowed several years before. Since she would inherit the crown of Castile and León, her father arranged for her to marry the King of Aragon. Alfonso the Battler, now an experienced soldier in his early 30s, could then defend the realm from the Almoravids. The old man died not long after, and Alfonso the Battler became king of Aragon and Navarre, León and Castile, Rex Hispania. But he held León and Castile only through his wife, and their marriage was a disaster. Urraca was a grown woman in her late 20s, not a naive young girl. She had a 4-year-old son from her previous marriage, and this child, not Alfonso the Battler, had the right to become the next ruler of León and Castile. She insisted on ruling her own part of the empire without her new husband's help, going so far as to banish her old tutor because he referred to Alfonso the Battler as King of Castile. On top of the political problems, she simply didn't like Alfonso. There was a want of affection between the wedded pair, says one chronicler. They quarrelled and separated within a matter of months. but Alfonso the Battler still claimed the title of king over the whole realm. During the next 8 years, he fought a constant war with the Almoravid armies along the frontier. Urraca also sent the armies of León Castile against the Almoravids. Periodically, the estranged husband and wife also fought against each other. Once Alfonso the Battler even captured his spouse and kept her for a while as a prisoner of war. The hostility between the Christian king and queen thwarted their attempts to fight the North African enemy. Thanks to their decaying marriage, the Almoravids kept power a little longer. Chapter 80. The Arrival of the Turks. Between 1025 and 1071, the Empress Zoe crowns three husbands, and the Seljuk Turks make themselves an empire. Back to the east, 11th-century Constantinople emerged from its self-absorption just in time to see a brand new enemy appear on the eastern horizon. Basil the Bulgar Slayer died in 1025. Constantine VIII, his young brother and heir, wore the sole crown of Byzantium for only 3 years. He was in his 60s and had spent his entire life hunting, horseback riding, and eating. He had no skill at governing and no experience as a soldier, a man of sluggish temperament with no great ambition for power, Michael Psellus writes, physically strong but a craven at heart. As a ruler, his greatest expertise was in the art of preparing rich, savory sauces. He had no sons and no heir. He had three daughters but had refused to let any of them marry, afraid that their husbands might try to unseat him. His reign was one of staggering irresponsibility. When his last illness struck him in 1028, he was finally forced to arrange for a successor. The city governor of Constantinople, Romanus Argyros, was an experienced official in his 60s and also happened to be the great-grandson of Emperor Romanus I. Constantine suggested that Romanus Argyros marry his middle daughter Zoe and be crowned along with her. Romanus Argyros was already married, and Zoe was 48 years old, but he didn't turn down the chance to become emperor. He sent his wife to a monastery and proposed to the middle-aged princess. The two were married on November 12, 1028. 3 days later, Constantine VIII died, and Romanus Argyros and his new wife were crowned as Romanus III and Empress Zoe, rulers of Byzantium. Romanus turned out to be a man with grand dreams and no talent for carrying them out. He gathered a huge army and marched against the Muslim border to the east. He raised taxes, hoping to make himself famous through enormous building projects, and he worked hard at siring an heir so that his dynasty would last forever. All of these projects backfired. The assault on the Muslim border ended with an embarrassing defeat. The new taxes made him hugely unpopular, and Zoe, nearly 50, was well past childbearing years. Michael Psellus remarks that Romanus found it easier to ignore this unpleasant truth. Even in the face of natural incapacity, he clung ever more firmly to his ambitions, led on by his own faith in the future, the chronicler says. He hired specialists, doctors who claimed they could cure sterility. He submitted himself to treatment with ointments and massage, and he enjoined his wife to do likewise. The specialist suggested to Zoe that she bejewel herself with magic charms whenever her husband visited her, which he did, often. Ultimately, though, Romanus was forced to give up hope. He was too old to continue the sexual marathon he had instituted, and Zoe showed no signs of recovering from menopause. Discouraged, he abandoned her bedchamber altogether. This was fine with Zoe. She had begun a torrid affair with the palace chamberlain, Michael the Paphlagonian, a handsome and pliable young man whose brother was a powerful palace eunuch. As Romanus's popularity plummeted, Zoe decided that the elderly husband her father had lumbered her with had to go. She probably began to dose his food with poison. His courtiers noticed that he grew weak and short of breath, his face swollen and discolored. His hair began to fall out. One morning he was bathing alone when he slipped beneath the water and drowned. Apparently Zoe had expected the accidental drowning, because she married Michael the Paphlagonian on the evening of the same day and ordered the patriarch to crown him as emperor. Although charming and clever, Michael was frequently ill, he was probably epileptic, and his short reign was a disaster on both political and personal fronts. It soon became clear that a puppet master held his strings, not the empress, but Michael's brother John, the powerful palace eunuch. Many of the castrated men who served in Constantinople were slaves or prisoners, but Byzantium had its share of native-born eunuchs. Young boys with royal blood were often castrated to keep them from claiming the throne. Even more commonly, rural parents with numerous sons would castrate two or three and send them off to the capital city to make their fortunes. They couldn't all stay on the farm, and since eunuchs had no sons of their own and no ambitions to build dynasties, they had a distinct advantage at court. John and Michael had come from a farming family in Paphlagonia with five sons. John had been castrated, Michael spared. John's competence and Michael's beauty had secured both a place at court, and John, the more intelligent and driven of the two, had masterminded his brother's affair with the Empress. Now Michael was emperor, and John, nicknamed Orphanatrophus, because he had charge of the official state orphanage in Constantinople, was the power behind the throne. Psellus, who as a boy met the eunuch in person, says that John Orphanatrophus was shrewd, meticulous, and devoted to his brother's success. He never forgot his zeal for duty, even at the times which he devoted to pleasure, Psellus says. Nothing ever escaped his notice. Everyone feared him and trembled at his superintendence. Under John's guidance, Michael began to hem Zoe in, reducing her influence at court. He confined her to her chambers and ordered that anyone visiting her had to be cleared by her honor guard. Meanwhile, he had also stopped sleeping with her. His epilepsy had grown worse, and he had become impotent. Zoe fought back in the only way she could. Now well into her 50s, she began an affair with another younger man, a bureaucrat named Constantine Monomachos, who had just entered his 30s. Michael IV was annoyed enough by this to exile Constantine Monomachos to the island of Lesbos, the traditional exile spot for malfeasance. But Constantine Monomachos was hardly Michael's greatest problem. The epileptic attacks were coming more frequently, often in full view of Michael's subjects. He could no longer go out in public without a band of attendants who would circle him if he fell into a seizure, so that no one could see his convulsions. John Orphanatrophus took steps to preserve the family's power. He suggested that Michael adopt as his son and heir their 25-year-old nephew, their older sister's son, also named Michael. The adoption was completed in 1040. By the middle of 1041, Michael IV was barely able to walk. The power of nature could not be mastered, Psellus writes, nor could the emperor vanquish and overwhelm this disease forever. Secretly and step by step it advanced to the final dissolution. He died in December, aged 31, and his nephew was crowned as Michael V in his place. Michael V was anxious to shake off the control of his powerful uncle. Once he was on the throne, he ordered both his uncle and his adoptive mother Zoe banished. He had overestimated his authority, though. John Orphanatrophus was respected, if not particularly popular, but Zoe, still beautiful, charismatic, and badly treated, was loved. The indignation was universal, and all were ready to lay down their lives for Zoe, Psellus says. He was actually in Constantinople at the time of the riot, and describes mobs in the streets, armed with axes, broadswords, spears, and stones, ready to kill Michael V as soon as he showed his face. In disguise, Michael sneaked down to the port and set sail for a nearby monastery. He took refuge in the church there, clinging to the altar. The mob followed him, dragged him away and blinded him with a sharp iron. They left him there and returned to the city, where Zoe and her sister Theodora were acclaimed as co-empresses. So the empire passed into the hands of the two sisters, Psellus says, and for the first time in our lives, we saw the transformation of the women's quarters into an emperor's council chamber. Zoe, now 63, recalled from exile and married her young bureaucratic lover, Constantine Monomachos, and had him crowned as emperor, the third man to gain his power through marriage to her. It was an impressive career for an 11th-century woman. Even in her 60s, she remained attractive. She had golden hair, and her whole body was radiant with the whiteness of her skin, writes Michael Psellus, who saw her himself. There were few signs of age in her. In fact, you would have said that here was a young woman, for no part of her skin was wrinkled, but all smooth and taut, and no furrows anywhere. The golden hair undoubtedly owed something to art. Psellus adds that she kept an entire chamber stocked with lotions, creams, and other beauty aids, but Zoe was apparently gifted with amazingly good genes. The men who ascended to power with her help were not as lucky. Constantine Monomachos now found himself at the head of an empire threatened on almost every side by outside powers. The personal had taken center stage at court for too long. Byzantium had begun to slip little by little from the heights that Basil II had attained. Constantine Monomachus was forced to deal with a rebellion by one of his generals, an attack from the Rus, a migration of Pecheng refugees across the frozen Danube, and hostile Muslim forces to the east. He coped with these problems one by one, but in 1048, 6 years after his coronation, he came face to face with an enemy he could not conquer. The enemy was Togrul, the Turkish chief who had led his coalition in the conquest of the Ghaznavid lands west of the Indus Mountains. Togrul had now been at the head of his tribe, the Seljuk Turks, for 20 years. They were, in the words of historian René Grousset, a horde without tradition and the least civilized of all the nomad clans, but Togrul had provided them with a path into nationhood. He had himself crowned Sultan of the Turks in 1038 and had established his capital at Nishapur. His Turks were now strong enough to challenge Byzantium. The first Turkish raid into Byzantine territory came in 1046. It was only a tentative prod at the Byzantine borders, and the Turks who came into Armenia withdrew without causing any real damage. But in 1048, a much larger Turkish army breached the eastern border and captured the rich border city of Erzen. Constantine Monomachus sent an army of 50,000 to drive the invaders back. In a sharp, nasty battle on the city's plain, the Byzantine soldiers were badly defeated. The Seljuk Turks took thousands of prisoners, with the Byzantine commanding general among them, and captured the army supplies as well, thousands of wagons filled with food, dry goods, and money. Constantine Monomachus decided to make a treaty with the Seljuk Turks instead of continuing to fight. In exchange for peace and the return of the captives, he agreed to give up some of the land on the eastern frontier. He also sent expensive gifts to Togrul and promised that he would allow Muslims to worship freely in Constantinople. The Turks had converted to Islam, and this was a gesture of friendship. Togrul accepted the terms and sent Constantine's commander back to Constantinople unharmed. For the moment, fighting was over, but the treaty was a devil's deal. Like every emperor since Basil II, Constantine Monomachus's biggest concern was surviving as emperor. Fighting to keep the throne he had married, rather than inherited, absorbed him. As he held on to the empire, it shrank in his hands like a treasured and much-guarded balloon. He was also ill. He had suffered for some time from a disease that racked him with painful muscle convulsions and slowly paralyzed him. His fingers, completely altered from their natural shape, warped and twisted with hollows here and projections there, Psellus writes. His feet were bent, and his knees, crooked like the point of a man's elbow. He was forced to give up, first riding, and then walking. Breathing became difficult. Talking caused him pain. Beating off the Turks must have seemed entirely impossible. Soon the problem of the Turks passed to the next generation. Zoe died in 1050 at aged 72, still wearing thin dresses and presiding as the great beauty of Constantinople. The much younger Constantine Monomachus followed her in 1055. The elderly Theodora, left alone on the throne, died in 1056. Before her death, she declared that the throne should pass to her trusted minister, Michael Bringas, a man who was not much younger than she, and who instantly was nicknamed Michael Gerontas, or Michael the Aged. Meanwhile, Togrul was closing his grip tightly around the Muslim lands to the south. The Buyid dynasty, much weaker than it had once been, still controlled Baghdad. In 1056, as Michael the Aged was ascending to the throne in Constantinople, Togrul marched into Baghdad and removed it firmly from Buyid control, driving the last Buyid rulers into exile. The Abbasid caliph still lived in Baghdad. He still retained some spiritual authority, although not a shred of political power, and Togrul made a deal with him. The caliph could remain peacefully in Baghdad as long as he agreed to recognize Togrul as supreme sultan, highest authority in the Muslim world, in the Friday prayers. Once, the mention of anyone other than the caliph or his heir in the Friday prayers had been tantamount to treachery. Now the caliph himself would pray for the sultan. In the Abbasid realm, the divorce between political and spiritual power was complete. Togrul's triumphs in the south made the Byzantine army nervous. Michael the Aged did not inspire confidence in them. In 1057, the soldiers in Constantinople proclaimed their own commander, Isaac Comnenus, as emperor in the old man's place. Michael the Aged offered to make him heir to the throne instead, but the people of Constantinople rioted, clamouring for Isaac. Michael VI had neither the energy nor the ambition to fight popular opinion. He abdicated peacefully and became a monk, dying 2 years later in his bed. Constantinople celebrated the coronation of the new emperor. At last a soldier sat on the throne, a man who could drive back the Turkish advance. All the populace of the city poured out to honour him, Psellus writes. Some brought lighted torches, as though he were God himself, while others sprinkled sweet perfumes over him. There was dancing and rejoicing everywhere. Unfortunately, their hopes were dashed. Isaac Comnenus had a short and unimpressive tenure as emperor. He almost immediately made himself unpopular at court by proposing massive government reforms, and then, before he could carry most of them out, he grew ill, probably with pneumonia, and died. In his place, the bureaucrat Constantine Doukas was crowned, and although Constantine Doukas managed to stay in power for 8 years, he paid little attention to the Turkish advances in the east. Not until 1068 did Constantinople get another soldier on the throne, the general Romanus Diogenes, who was crowned as Romanus IV, senior co-emperor along with Constantine Doukas's sons. Togrul, Sultan of the Turks, had died of old age in 1063, leaving no sons. His nephew, Alp Arslan, the name means valiant lion, had inherited his power and now led the Turks. He had his eye on the Byzantine land in Asia Minor, and Romanus, recognizing the danger of Turkish growth, finally organized a campaign against the eastern border. Driving forward against the Turks, he pushed into the land they had already taken. In 1070, in a series of hard-fought battles, he managed to drive them back across the Euphrates. His years of campaigning had taught him the best way to deal with the lightly armed, fast-moving Turkish cavalry. Keep the army bunched together, not spread out into a line, with bowmen protecting the slow, heavily armed cavalry on all sides. Alp Arslan's retreat had been a strategic one, allowing him to regather his forces. In 1071, he advanced again into Byzantine territory, and Romanus marched out to meet him at the head of 60,000 soldiers. But this time Romanus IV suffered from a severe attack of overconfidence. He didn't know exactly where Alp Arslan and the bulk of his army had camped, and rather than holding his men together until he could get firm intelligence, he divided his army in half and sent 30,000 men off to attack a nearby fortress. He marched with his remaining men to the city of Manzikert, right on the frontier between Byzantine and Turkish territory, and captured it. All this time, Alp Arslan was just beyond Manzikert, keeping tabs on the emperor's movements. 3 days after the capture of Manzikert, as Romanus IV advanced cautiously into Turkish territory, he met what appeared to be a band of Turkish raiders. He drew up his army in a single line to drive them back. They retreated in front of him. Delighted with his victory, he led the Byzantine troops after them, pursuing them on into the late afternoon. But the raiders were merely the front edge of Alp Arslan's massive force. As soon as the sun set, the Turks surrounded the strung-out army and massacred them in the twilight. It was like an earthquake, with howling, sweat, a swift rush of fear, clouds of dust, one of the survivors later wrote. Each man sought safety in flight. Most of the Byzantine troops were caught and killed as they tried to escape. Romanus IV was captured and taken back to Alp Arslan's camp as a prisoner. The other 30,000 soldiers disappeared from history. In all likelihood, they too were ambushed and slaughtered. Alp Arslan, rubbing salt in the emperor's wounds, treated him with honor, fed him from the sultan's own table and set him free, after extracting from him solemn vows of friendship and peace. Romanus, in a state of high embarrassment, began the journey back to Constantinople. Just as the Battle of Manzikert had destroyed most of the Byzantine army, so the captivity and the oath had destroyed his reputation. Michael Psellus himself declared that Romanus's young co-emperors, the sons of Constantine Doukas, had no obligation to let the humiliated ruler back into the city. A handful of trusted men, including members of the Doukas family, set off to intercept Romanus on his way home. They captured him, blinded him, and left him in a monastery to die. Now the oldest son of Constantine Doukas, Michael VII, became senior emperor, an event marked by a second coronation in October 1071, but he ruled over a changed map. The Sultan of the Seljuk Turks had established a new Turkish outpost in Asia Minor, in lands that had once been Byzantine. A vassal ruler, the Sultan of Rum, presided over this new Turkish state. The Turks had rooted themselves into Asia Minor and intended to remain. The massacre of the army at Manzikert had made it impossible for the Byzantines to muster a force large enough to drive them out. Chapter 81. The Loss of the Song. Between 1032 and 1172, the Jurchen sweep down from the north, and the Song are driven from the Yellow River Valley. The Song dynasty had not lost its fascination for those on the outside. In 1032, the strongest outsiders lived in the kingdom of the Western Xia, and they had their eyes fixed on the wealth and culture of the Song. The Western Xia had been nomads who wandered up from the south. Between 982 and 1032, their great chief, Li Daiming, had managed to organize the tribal confederation into a state. He had ambitions to educate his son, Li Yuanhao, into a true monarch. Just before his death in 1032, Li Daiming sent 70 horses as a gift to Song Renzong, asking for a copy of the Buddhist scriptures so that he could complete Li Yuanhao's training. Apparently, the Song Emperor ignored the request, because in 1035, Li Yuanhao, now ruler of the Western Xia state, asked for the scriptures again. This time, his envoy returned with the books. The volumes of Buddhist teachings helped to support Li Yuanhao's efforts to become the emperor of a civilized nation, rather than the war leader of a tribal confederation. To be a monarch as great as the ancient Chinese monarchs meant accepting the religion of the Chinese throne, even though the Buddhism held by the Song court did not stretch back nearly to the times of the semi-divine sage emperors. At Li Yuanhao's public enthronement, carried out once the Buddhist scriptures were in hand, his ministers declared him to be sage of culture and hero of war, like the emperors of the distant Chinese past. The title has survived because Li Yuanhao had thrown his energies behind the creation of a script for his native Tongut language, a complicated system based on Chinese principles. Using the new lines and strokes, his chronicler recorded the details of his coronation. Li Yuanhao knew that without books of their own, his people would have no past. Without a past, they could never claim to be equal to the Song. In 1038, he sent a letter to Song Renzong, demanding official Chinese recognition of his new status. The letter lists all of the reforms Li Yuanhao instituted in the Western Xia lands, including his creation of written language for the Tangut. It then gets to the point. Now that the dress regulations have been completed, he writes, the script put into effect, the rites and music made manifest, the vessels and implements prepared. I was enthroned at Shizu, originator of literature, rooted in might, giver of law, founder of ritual, humane and filial emperor. My country is called Great Xia, and the reign era is called heaven-conferred rights, law, and protracted blessings. I humbly look to your majesty the emperor, in your profound wisdom and perfection, whose benevolence extends to all things, to permit me to be invested as the ruler facing south in this western land. The polite request covered over steely determination. 30 years earlier, the Song emperor's father had been forced to recognize the Liao ruler as an emperor with status equal to himself, and now the Western Xia ruler wanted the same. Unlike the great dynasties of the past, the Song did not dominate the East. It was only one kingdom in a landscape of kingdoms. It was not notably more prosperous than its neighbors. But the Song emperor had something the northern and western kings did not. He had the sheen of millennia of tradition, and they wanted some of that gloss for themselves. If he didn't yield it, they were ready to fight for it. Song Renzong declined to bestow the title of emperor on the western upstart, and in 1038, the Western Xia army invaded. 30 years of peace had softened the Song border troops. One chronicler notes that less than half of the soldiers were still able to draw the heavy crossbows used in battle, and almost none of the officers or troops had combat experience. Between 1038 and 1042, the Western Xia overran the forts along the western frontier. Li Yuanhao advanced his men cautiously, not attempting to capture more of the difficult rocky terrain than he could defend. Slowly, the western reaches of the Song were eaten away, and in 1042, the situation grew worse when the Liao to the north demanded another chunk of Song territory for themselves. Song Renzong offered to increase the annual tribute instead. This avoided a two-front war but drained the Song treasury even further. By 1044, he had decided to make peace. He still refused to recognize the Western Xia ruler as a real emperor, but he paid out yet more annual tribute to buy a truce. Li Yuanhao agreed to the compromise. 6 years of fighting had stressed his own army, and even though he had failed to get the legitimization he craved, the money was an effective salve to his wounded personal pride. The Song, meanwhile, had turned their attention back towards military matters. Apparently the war with the Western Xia had forced the Song generals to scramble for information. By 1044, the last year of the war, a band of scholars commissioned to put together a compendium on techniques of war had finished their work. The volume, Wu Jing Zong Yao, describes a pump-powered flamethrower that could hurl naphtha, the same Greek fire used by the defenders of Constantinople. It also explains how to make explosive black powder from coal, saltpeter, and sulfur, the first time in history that the formula for gunpowder appears in writing. The purchased truce lasted for some time on both the northern and western borders, giving the Song time to rebuild their military might. Song Renzong raised taxes to pay for the tribute, as well as a newly expanded national army. He also ordered new standards put into place for new army recruits. They would have to pass an eye exam, as well as tests in running, jumping, and shooting. This time, the temporary peace would be used to prepare for the next war. The peace lasted for almost 50 years. The Liao had earned official imperial recognition from the Song Empire, along with cash payments. The Western Xia had received only the cash, but had decided to be content. And then another tribe, making the same journey from nomadic wanderings to settled empire, blew in from the north at the beginning of the 12th century and swept down onto the settled kingdoms. They were the Jurchen, tribes who spoke a language distantly related to the Turkish tongues. They lived mostly on the wooded plains north of Goryeo, in the lands later called Manchuria. Some of the western groups had come under the rule of Liao and were known as the civilized Jurchen, but the eastern bands were still free and wild. The Song and Liao courts called these the raw Jurchen, and they roamed beyond the control of either emperor. Late in the 11th century, one of the